TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. When the FBI knocks on the door. How the peace movement resisted FBI infiltration and accusation of terrorism. The largest deployment of FBI agents for a political case since the counterintelligence programs against the civil rights movement, the Black Panthers, the American Indian Movement, and the Young Lords occurred on September 24, 2010. In a joint national operation, the FBI targeted homes and offices of people who had organized peace rallies against the post-9/11 wars. This time, the accusation was providing material support to foreign terrorist organizations. In the end, this giant and expensive FBI operation did not yield a single charge. However, the 2010 raids and the confiscated materials were used against two prominent activists who were affiliated with the peace movement, the Brown Berets co-founder Carlos Montes and the Palestinian-American Razmir O'Day, leader in the Chicago Arab American community. In early January 2016, at the Third Unitarian Church, Chicago, Joe Osbaker brought the community up to date on events that began with the 2010 FBI raids and led to the vibrant solidarity movements for Razmir O'Day. Instead of being intimidated by the threat of the FBI, people rallied, raised money for defense, brought in union members, the founders of Black Lives Matter, and prominent people such as Angela Davis. Joe Osbaker is chief steward and member of the executive board of Local 73 SEIU in Chicago. He begins the story on the day the FBI came to his door in September 2010.
One morning, there was a knock on our door at 7 a.m., and when I came downstairs, there were half a dozen people standing on our front porch, and I opened the door, and the man in front, young guy, looked like a, late 20s, kind of dressed in office casual, handed me a warrant to search our home, saying that my wife at the time, and I were under investigation for conspiracy to provide material support to foreign terrorist organizations in Palestine and in Colombia. And at the moment that they were raiding our house, they were raiding six other homes, as well as visiting other activists in Wisconsin, in North Carolina, and in California, and in Arizona. Altogether, there were over 70 special agents in the field that morning from six different U.S. attorney districts. It was the largest mobilization or deployment of FBI agents for a political case since COINTELPRO, since the early 1970s. And after they handed us the warrant, they then handed us subpoenas saying that we were required to appear in front of a federal grand jury investigating these same allegations. And they arrived at 7 in the morning, and they did not leave until 6:30 in the evening. And then, it took us a while because we didn't have cell phones. It took us a while to figure out, like, how many people were being raided and what was happening around the country. And then, within a couple of hours, we figured out the only thing that we all had done together was we had been among the coordinators of the last big march against the Iraq War, which was at the Republican National Convention in St. Paul, Minnesota, on Labor Day of 2008. So in the weeks that followed that, we were able to piece together that during the organizing for that march, the FBI and the Joint Terrorism Task Force, which labels any national march at any of the RNCs or DNCs or, you know, any march on Washington, they label them as national security events, which then justifies sending in the Joint Terrorism Task Force to send in undercover officers. And the peace coalition that we had formed had been infiltrated by at least two undercover agents. So when the protest happened, there were a bunch of young people, anarchists and anti-authoritarians, who were also infiltrated, and they got terrorism charges, which were all dismissed. But we didn't have any charges at the protest itself. And then 2 years later, the FBI showed up at our door, and these the undercovers that infiltrated us, they stuck around. They became core activists in the anti-war movement for 2.5 years. And it was based on the fantastic lies that they told about us. Gun training?
Really?
Gun training? That's what we were engaged in, among other things. It was based on these fantastic lies that these two women told about us. So they subpoenaed us to a grand jury, and you know, I didn't really understand how a grand jury worked until I was subpoenaed to one, and then the National Lawyers Guild lawyers explained to us that a prosecutor can get a grand jury to do whatever they want them to do. Your lawyer does not have the right to object to who they put on the grand jury. It's entirely selected by the prosecutor. There is no judge in a grand jury. It's just the prosecutor and 23 people that they picked. You don't have the right to present a defense. You don't have the right to question any witness that they bring against you. You don't have the right to see any evidence that they have to present against you. It's, you know, like the Star Chamber. Yeah, it's a kangaroo court. And what did they want to ask us about? They wanted to ask us about, you know, our solidarity work with Palestine and people in Colombia. And, you know, we were always very open about our sympathies. But what they were suggesting we did was provide material support, which means money. And, you know, that's illegal. And we knew it was illegal, and so, you know, we never tried to do it. So they said, we want you to come in and testify to this grand jury. But, you know, obviously in the U.S., if you go in and talk to a grand jury, you know, your fellow activists might be brought in for interrogation. But in Palestine, if they were able to link us to anyone in Palestine, in Palestine they don't interrogate them, they torture them or they kill them. And in Colombia it's the same thing. It's, you know, it's the most brutal counterinsurgency war in the world. So we said, at that first weekend there were 14, and then eventually they subpoenaed 9 more for a total of 23 people. It's the largest, you know, largest political case in the country since the Black Panther 21, and all 23 of us agreed that we were not going to appear in front of that grand jury, and each one of us then had to deal with the consequences of that. The consequences are that you can be imprisoned for up to 18 months for simply taking your Fifth Amendment right not to self-incriminate, because in front of a grand jury you don't have your Fifth Amendment right. So they never brought charges against us, and we were able to build an enormous support movement. We eventually got unions representing over 1 million workers to pass resolutions in our defense. We got 14 members of Congress to write letters to Eric Holder saying, essentially, you've got the wrong people. And it actually revived the peace movement in Chicago, which had been in pretty sick shape prior to us being raided. You know, now here we are, over 5 years later, they've never charged any of us. We're looking at the end of this story, except they used the investigation of us digging through our lives to go after two veterans of the movement. The first person they went after was one of the speakers at that protest at the RNC in 2008, was one of the founders of the Brown Berets. He's a guy named Carlos Montes, and he's iconic in Los Angeles. Like, every Chicano studies course in America teaches who Carlos Montes is. You know, he's like, you know, the Huey Newton or Bobby Seale of the Chicano youth movement of the late 60s. And they dug through his life until they found an unresolved court case from 1969 in which he was accused of throwing a pop can at a cop. And then he actually fled. He went underground. He came back 7 years later and got it settled as a misdemeanor. But the FBI said, no, you're a felon, and you've never stood trial for this. So we're going to put you on trial and threaten him with 22 years in prison for avoiding the law. So we had to defend him. And that took a year and tens of thousands of dollars. Then, 6 months after we beat those charges, Resmia Odeh, who's a friend of ours here in Chicago, one morning in October of 2013, Department of Homeland Security knocks on her door in Evergreen Park and says, you know, you're under arrest. And they brought her in front of the federal court here in Chicago. And the charge against her was that she had falsely acquired citizenship because she failed to reveal that she was actually a high-level terrorist in Palestine. This is the story, and I'm sorry about that long-winded introduction, but like, I just want you to understand, like, this is not just a case that I care about. This is my case. They found her digging through the lives and the files of the activists. She was in all of our cell phones, lots of meetings I had been at with her, and she was working with Hatem Aboudeya, who was, you know, the director of the Arab American Action Network, and they raided his house. So I can imagine the frustration of the U.S. attorneys, that they spent millions of dollars investigating the 23 of us and didn't even get to go to court. What a frustrating thing for these, you know, these gunslingers. So they want somebody to put on trial. So they found this dangerous person. So what's the basis of their charges against her? In 1969, Resmia was arrested in Jerusalem along with 500 other people in her neighborhood. She was 21 years old. You know, her family had been, you know, one of the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands that were displaced by the, you know, the founding of the State of Israel. And then she was, you know, she lived in a refugee camp, and then she was eventually living in the West Bank. And when they arrested those 500 people, why? There had been a bombing in Jerusalem the previous night. And so they went looking for someone that they could say was the bomber. They arrested her, and they took her to, you know, this is a military occupation. These are soldiers. And they take her to a military prison where they tortured her. And, you know, I never knew what they had done to her until, you know, I've known her since, like I said, for over 10 years. Some of the other Palestinians had always said, you know, she was a victim of torture, but I'd never actually asked her or read what the Israeli soldiers did to her, and it's bestial. And they raped her. They used electric shock. And the thing that finally made her crack and sign the confession that she had done this bombing was they brought her father in and raped her in front of her father. And at that point, she just said, I will sign anything. Also, they had not allowed her to see a lawyer. And they didn't allow her to see a lawyer for almost 2 months. And as soon as she got a lawyer in her cell, she said, it's a lie. I didn't do this. I was tortured into signing this confession. And she has maintained that innocence for 46 years. When she was released from prison, she was given a life sentence, but then she was, you know, released in a prisoner exchange 10 years later. She went directly to the United Nations Special Commission on Torture and testified and told all of this. And if you have the stomach to read it, it's all online. Her dad was an American citizen. He was an auto worker in Dearborn. And some years later, she was, you know, living and working in Jordan, her dad got sick, and her brother, also an American citizen, also living in Dearborn, said, you know, you don't have any kids. Can you come to Dearborn and take care of dad? So she did. She applied for a visa, and then she was here for 10 years, and she applied for citizenship, and it was awarded to her. This woman is famous in Palestine. She has been since the moment her trial, I mean, her case became public. She's a famous political prisoner. The U.S. government knew who she was. She testified in front of the U.N. The whole legal structure of the American foreign policy knew who she was. And they allowed her to emigrate, and they allowed her to obtain citizenship. And 10 years later, they said, oh, well, we reviewed your case, and you lied on your application for citizenship because you didn't tell us you are a terrorist. And she said, I'm not a terrorist. I'm a victim. And on the application, it says, you know, have you ever been convicted of a crime? And, you know, she answered no, and I'll explain that in a minute. You know, why she answered it that way. So they arrested her, they put her on trial, and then they convicted her of falsely acquiring citizenship. And that was in the fall of 2014. So her lawyers, they filed an appeal, and the appeal was finally heard this fall. And this is the basis of the appeal. First of all, she was denied her defense. This is in the Constitution. You have the right to present the defense, you know, the best defense that you can. Well, her best defense is that she's the victim. She's not a terrorist. She was tortured into this confession. The judge ruled that she would not be allowed to use the word torture or to talk about anything that happened to her in prison in Israel. Would not allow it. The judge also allowed the prosecution in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Eastern Michigan, in Detroit, they were allowed to talk about the crimes that she had committed. And they were allowed to present evidence from the same Israeli court that she was not allowed to mention. And more, even more pertinent to U.S. jurisprudence, all of these years, Rasmiya has never gone to therapy. You know, for those of us in our culture, that's pretty shocking. But, you know, for most cultures in the world, therapy is something that, you know, they don't do. So when faced with, you know, prison and deportation, her lawyers said, you know, we have to get you to talk to an expert. So she went to the Kovler Center. And, you know, one of the PhDs there said, this woman is the victim of torture. And that doctor, Mary Masri, was, we got the judge to agree to have her testify, not in front of a jury, but just in front of the judge in Detroit. And the judge initially agreed that the jury would be allowed to hear that testimony. And then the prosecution objected. And the judge overturned his own decision. And so, again, Rasmiya was denied her defense. As I said, not only was she denied her defense, the prosecution submitted documents and testimony and evidence obtained, not just that was tortured out of her. This is evidence from the Israeli military occupation force in the West Bank. This is an illegal occupation. This is a military occupation that has been condemned. I mean, it can't go to the World Court because the U.S. won't allow it in front of the World Court, but it has been condemned by 97% of the country, the countries representing 97% of humanity. The occupation of Palestine is illegal. And yet, you know, our government says this is valid evidence, and oh, we're not allowed in our court system to consider evidence based on torture. Well, unless it comes from the Israelis, in which case we will consider evidence such as that. So this is where the case stands. She had her appeal hearing. She's presented it in front of the 6th District Court in Cincinnati. This was in October. And we are waiting for a decision. Her defense committee, which you know I'm a part of, our intention is, if they deny her, her lawyers have the option to appeal to the whole circuit court, or to take it to the Supreme Court. And I'm not a lawyer, so I don't exactly know what all of their thinking is, but those are the options. And in the meantime, what we do is we continue to, you know, to spread the word and tell this story and appeal for support. And then, of course, you know, this defense has cost us somewhere in the order of $100,000. And I think I'm going to stop there, because I think I went over my 20 minutes.
So. No, you're perfect. All right.
That was Joe Osbaker, member of the executive board of Local 73 SEIU in Chicago. He spoke at the Third Unitarian Church, with music drifting in from another event down the hall. The evening went on with questions and answers.
Have you noticed Razmiya's photo next to a man who has spoken at our forums?
I just want to say one thing, though, in response to Jerry pointing out that photo. The other person in that photo is, of course, the iconic Angela Davis. And it must be galling, I hope it's galling, to the prosecutors in this case that this woman who they have targeted and whose life they're attempting to ruin has become famous to a new generation, not just of Palestinians, but to the movement in the U.S. Not only did Angela also submit, by the way, an op-ed piece to the Detroit Free Press just prior to Razmiya's trial, in which Angela said, if you supported me when I was on trial, you have to support Razmiya. But since then, Razmiya has been embraced by the Black Lives Matter movement. A video was released just at the time of her appeal. The image is her, Danny Glover, and one of the women that founded the Black Lives Matter movement, like the three of them, and you click on it and there's like, you know, it's like 4 or 5 minutes of poetry and images of protest. And Razmiya's image and the image of Palestine is like woven together. In a sense, it's backfired in the faces of the U.S. attorney, as it backfired on them when they raided and subpoenaed us.
Address the role of the Zionists infiltrating the Justice Department and universities. Can you speak to that kind of influence that they've had in corrupting the Justice Department to the extent that it's being used to target political activists who are challenging the Zionist settler project called Israel?
You know, there are so many examples that you can point to. The main one is right after 9/11, the U.S. government went after the largest Muslim foundation in America, and the five men who headed it were put on trial and convicted of providing material support to a foreign terrorist organization. And what had they been doing? They'd been providing food and medical care to the wrong children, to the children of Gaza. And in order to get money to the children of Gaza, it has to go through organizations, the Zakat committees. And these men got 65-year sentences for doing this. And the man who prosecuted them is the guy who's investigating us, Barry Jonas. This is his career. This is what he's done in the Department of Justice for the last 15 years. He hunts Muslims, and he hunts people who get too close to Muslims. and we are his other biggest case, and we've denied him a victory so far. We feel pretty proud of ourselves.
You know, I think there are terrorists out there, and I think it's kind of scary and crazy that the government is spending all this money on people who aren't terrorists.
Well, I think that it's pretty clear that there are organizations, military organizations in the world that use terror. The largest of them, the best known of them, receive an enormous amount of support from the U.S. Foreign policy apparatus. I traveled to Syria a year and a half ago to go observe the elections there. Everyone in Syria knew that ISIS and Al-Qaeda in Syria were fighting with American weapons. They were getting intelligence from the CIA in Jordan. You know, everybody talks about this joke that there are 50 trained moderate Syrian rebels that the U.S. spent $500 million. But it's an open secret that the U.S. spent $10 billion in Jordan training people who are mostly today fighting with ISIS and the al-Nusra Front. So the whole war on terror has a number of layers to it, but one of the things that it has is to install fear in the American people. And there's the broad fear that gets people not to question what the government is doing, but then there's a targeted fear where they come after the movement. And they say, essentially, the message to the movement is, if you dare express sympathy with the oppressed people of the world, this is what's going to happen to you. And that's why one of our messages to anyone who gets visited by the FBI is, don't keep it to yourself. This operation, this repression of the movement, this needs disinfectant. This needs sunlight. We have to speak up, and we can't remain silent.
On that note, can everybody give him a round of applause?
Thank you.
And that was the end of a meeting in support of the Palestinian-American Razmiya O'Day, held in the Third Unitarian Church, Chicago. The meeting was recorded by Dale Lehman on January 10, 2016, and produced by me 1 month later in anticipation of the response by the Circuit Court to Razmiya O'Day's appeal of her conviction to prison and deportation. For updates and background information, go to www.stopfbi.net. That's stopfbi.net. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.